the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our first guest this morning is Weather Channel host Creek Stewart, who is also a best-selling author and disaster expert who will join us to discuss emergency preparedness and his new book called The Disaster Ready Home, a step-by-step emergency preparedness manual for sheltering in place. Creek calls it an inevitability for all of us to withstand some emergency or disaster anytime soon.
And our second guest this morning is senior editor at Scientific American, Josh Fishman. He will join our program. It's more important than ever to learn the intricacies of current science with COVID. What's new with Omicron? What's the holdup with the new vaccines? And when's the right time to use a rapid test, if you can find one?
That's right. These two guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio on KPCW Park City. Stay with us.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. If a disaster forces you to shelter in place, do you think you'd have everything you need to safely and comfortably stay put in your home? Well, the folks in Boulder and Denver, Colorado in December had in some cases only 15 minutes to evacuate. Do you imagine any of them were ready? Well, our next guest is best-selling author, disaster expert, and Weather Channel host Creek Stewart. He joins us to discuss emergency preparedness in his new book, The Disaster Ready Home, a step-by-step emergency preparedness manual for sheltering in place. Creek Stewart, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we're glad to have you with the program. The timing is pretty good. let's just talk about your book a little bit. It's broken down into three major pieces: food, water, and heating and sanitation. And it goes into a lot of details. What I really appreciate about the book is that you have, over the years, gone and tried all sorts of things. You know what works, you know what doesn't work as far as the type of container for water or things to think about when you're building a compost toilet, all these different things. And you share all of that with us, and you also provide websites to be able to go in and get additional detail. Is that the way you wanted to set the book up?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really, all the information is really targeted towards somebody who may have never thought of at-home preparedness before. So I wanted to keep it really simple, really practical, really affordable, and just set the standard that you don't have to move to the mountains or get a solar or go solar or start homesteading. It can be much simpler and more practical than that for the average person.
Right. And I am from Boston and also the North Shore of Massachusetts, on the shore, living on the shore. And we would have these winter storms that would track north. They'd go out to sea and then they'd come roaring back. They're called nor'easters. And we would sometimes lose our power for 3 or 4 days. And boy, I tell you, it was tough. I wish I had this book at the time.
Yeah, disasters happen everywhere, right? So they're different in different regions and different areas. But the good news is that all of our human needs and survival concerns are the same regardless of where we're at and what's happening. So the main categories to think about are food, water, off-grid cooking, off-grid heating, and sanitation. So no matter what disaster might be coming down the pike, we still have all the same categories to think about.
So, Creek, bringing it back to sort of what happened in Boulder and Denver just weeks ago, and with some thousand homes burning to the ground, and I had read about how many cars were they were rescuing, or not rescuing the cars, they were going in and taking out all of the cars that had been burned down, and there were so many. And the reason was that a lot of people didn't know how to open their garage doors without electricity. And so these most basic it's not even really survival, but it's basic, you know, response to emergency and to disasters that just completely slip our minds. I mean, what are some of the most basic things, you know, putting water and sanitation aside? You know, what are these basic things that we need to be aware of?
Well, there are so many. You know, one thing I've learned over the years teaching survival skills is that modern conveniences have lulled us as a society into a state of comfort that is really, really interesting that we've never seen before in human history. I teach in my survival courses, obviously, I teach how to start fires. And, you know, safely and effectively, both in a camping environment and in a survival scenario. And you would be surprised at the number of people who, you know, are just brand new to the idea of even safely starting a fire. And so, opening the garage door doesn't surprise me. That's probably one on a long list of skills that, you know, we take for granted that we should know that maybe some people don't. And, you know, I like to think that in this book, I've checked off a lot of those, what would seem like very common sense skills with preparedness. And I start the whole process off with really.
Yeah. Well, it's funny to think about the numbers of us who, you know, in Utah here, going camping is a very popular pastime. Most of us have our camping gear set up. And I was thinking about it the other day when our electricity went off. It's like all of our camping gear is in the trailer that's stored in some other place. It's not right here. We very well know how to, you know, start a fire or, you know, cook with a little propane canister or have our little solar generated light working. But it's not going to do us a lot of good if it's, you know, in storage somewhere. Little things like this are probably what you come up against every single day.
Yeah, and that's the whole premise of this initiative is to help people put in systems and materials and resources at home that are staying at home that are specifically for the purpose of disaster preparedness. Lose power, being trapped at home for an uncertain period of time. There's a lot of people who have been thinking about this in the past couple of years. I think the pandemic in particular really brought to the forefront the notion of, you know what, it made a lot of people really uncomfortable when they were quarantined at home and the grocery stores looked weird and it was a really weird time. And there's a lot more people right now thinking about what should I do? What are some basic things I can do to create a buffer between myself and a potential disaster just in case? It's at the top of mind for a lot of people right now.
Creek, Lynn and I were talking in the green room before the program, and we were talking about the folks in Boulder that had to scoot pretty quickly. They had maybe only 15 minutes to evacuate. And in your book, you have a section that talks about a rucksack, a knapsack that will get you from point A to point B in, you know, for 3 days, 3 days of food and water and, you know, all sorts of stuff in this pack that's already, you know, set to go that you can just grab and run out the door with. Can you tell us what's in that pack and some of your thoughts behind what you pack?
Yeah, it's a really great question. So obviously there's two sides to every disaster, right? So some people are trapped at home while other people may be forced to evacuate in order to be safe. So that's where what we call a bug out bag comes into play. It's a 72-hour disaster survival kit that's designed to get you and your family through 3 days of independent survival. So as far as the tools and resources that you want to have in there, you want to think about, like, what will I need for 3 days of independent survival if I'm on the go or in my car? Well, we definitely need food, right? I often recommend open and eat meals, just really simple power bars, energy bars that can get you through just 3 days, packets of peanut butter. We don't want to be cooking anything or rely on a heat source or boiling water or anything like that, because we may not have that luxury. So open and eat meals. We want to have fresh, clean drinking water ready to drink. So at least 1 liter per person in a metal container, just in case you'd need to boil and purify more. Basic hand tools like a multi-tool knife, just basic tools to deal with, you know, really simple rudimentary tasks that might be at hand. A shelter like a tarp, or even better yet, a tent, and then a couple changes of clothes as well. And there's a lot of items that can be on that list. A cell phone charger, and in fact, for you know, for people who may not have a bug out bag right now who want to build one, I have a free course on my website at creekstewart.com where you can sign up and I will walk you through day by day, step by step in building one of these bug out bags that can have you ready for about anything.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Creek Stewart, and he has written The Disaster Ready Home, a step-by-step emergency preparedness manual for sheltering in place. And we, of course, are always talking about shelf life, and if we're going to be keeping some food, you know, we have to rotate it and those sorts of things. But one piece of that, which I was just fascinated by, is that you speak about freeze-dried foods that have a shelf life of 25 years plus, and you can boil some water, open a packet, and you pour the water right in the packet, and there's your meal right there. Can you...
Yes.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. So freeze-dried foods are really popular for disaster preparedness and camping. They're the same type of meal packaged in a different way for different purposes. But they can also be pretty expensive. And, you know, people start thinking about, do I need buckets of freeze-dried meals in my basement? And I always think about, you know, the average person. And where I recommend everyone starts with a long-term food storage pantry is with a list of the 10 to 20 most popular items that you eat on a regular basis. The items that have a 1 to 3 year shelf life that you pick up in the inner aisles of your grocery store. So think canned goods, boxed meals, dried pastas, things that are going to last a little while. Once you have that list of 10 or 20 items, the next time you go to the grocery store, pick up 2 or 3 extras of a couple of those items and do that each time you go to the grocery store, and you will slowly build buffer a long-term food storage pantry of food that you know you're going to eat. And as you run out of that in your kitchen pantry, just rotate through items that you might be sitting in a closet or on a shelf. That way you store what you eat, and you eat what you store, and you're never wasting any more money on something that you're not going to eat. It's the easiest way to build up a long-term food storage pantry.
Creek, I'm wondering if you could make the distinction between, I think it would be called, you know, survivalist skills and just emergency preparedness. I know that, and maybe you've heard this too, I read something recently, you know, being in Utah, the home of the Latter-day Saints, and they, for a long time, had this philosophy around having storage in your basement, you know, good for I don't know how long. But now they've started to back away from that a little bit because this whole survivalist movement has become sort of fringy. Could you talk a little bit about the distinction there?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and one that is, you know, a huge part of my life and career, really, that I've seen over the course of the 20 years that I've been doing this. So there is a fine line between, you know, what people would perceive as being common sense prepared and what might seem like a little bit too much. And quite frankly, it's going to be different for everyone because everyone is, you know, everyone has different levels of comfort and, you know, they have the right to feel that way, whether they want to be prepared for 1 month or 1 year or even longer. At the end of the day, this is a topic that, you know, someone 2 years ago who might have been thinking, you know, that really stuff that preppers talk about in their basement and their survival meetings. You'd be surprised at the number of people now who are thinking, you know what, I'm not like a prepper, but I feel like I need to be having some things in place that maybe we don't have in place. What I teach and what I recommend to other people are very practical disaster preparedness strategies and tips and tricks for disasters that actually happen. Okay. So we're talking natural disasters and man-made disasters that happen on a regular basis all the time. I'm not talking about Yellowstone exploding or alien invasions or anything like that. So I want to make that really clear that, you know, you don't have to watch the news very long to realize that, you know, disasters are a part of our lives. They are just like, they are here. They are not going away. There are more of them. There are a wider variety of them, as we've seen in the past couple of years. And we are all affected by them on a regular basis. I have a saying that it's not if, but when. And I believe that to be true, that it's not if, but when each of us will be faced with some type of disaster scenario in our lives. And, you know, we don't want to be the person that said it will never happen to me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, I think in the West, at least we are getting all of us have gotten a taste of it because either we know someone who has had to evacuate or had their home burned down. You know, we had a wildfire pretty close to us here in Park City last year. And, you know, just those thoughts about evacuation and what to take, what to leave, how fast to evacuate, you know, and then there's the person who chooses not to evacuate, which must be, you know, something that you come up against a lot. These folks that just say, I'm going to shelter in place.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, there are certain disasters where that is a really bad idea. Okay. Some disasters trap you at home and either you're ready for that or you're not. And then some disasters, if you don't leave, it's more dangerous. And so I think if we really need to heed the warnings of local emergency first responders who are really equipped to let us know, you know, when it's time to go, and we need to do so. And part of disaster preparedness is being prepared to go with a bug out bag, with your documents and a fireproof safe, and taking some of those really necessary steps in advance of having to do that. And I think what keeps those people at home is it's just paralyzed by the fear and the uncertainty of actually leaving and not being ready to make that step. And so much of this is being prepared to act when you need to.
And it's not only safety for ourselves, but it's also protection of our asset, our home. And you talk on page 190 about the buddy heater. And I think about how difficult, you'd have to write some checks if all of a sudden you had pipes that were freezing and bursting. And the buddy heater, which runs off of propane, and you can hook it up to a 20-pound canister or a 1-pound canister, you could put that on low and just keep your pipes in good shape. I appreciated that. I'm going to get one of those buddy heaters.
Yeah, and off-grid heat is a really important thing for people to consider, not only for just keeping themselves warm, but like you said, to keep pipes from freezing in certain circumstances. Texas, early last year, really saw that firsthand. It was a part of the region that wasn't used to freezing cold temperatures, and you know, the number of pipes that exploded and the water shortages there was really unheard of at that time. And indoor space heaters can be a really easy solution for backup heat. Both kerosene space heaters and propane space heaters, there are approved versions for indoor use of both of those. Kerosene, propane store almost indefinitely, I mean years and years and years, so it's a really good investment of your money. And these heaters are inexpensive, around $100 for an indoor approved kerosene or propane heater.
Well, we have the solar panel technology down pretty good, but we really haven't, let's just say we have some work to do on the battery side. When that is done, will that be part of your program?
You know, solar is a really interesting animal for me. I am not a solar expert, but you know, I do know that the idea of solar is very overwhelming for your average person. You know, when you start talking about going off-grid solar, I mean, that's an entirely different lifestyle, really. I have friends who are off-grid solar, and they will be the first to tell you that this is a lifestyle you are thinking about all the time. You are making adjustments to it all the time. And for that reason, I don't know that it will be something that I will recommend as a part of my teaching, simply because it's just not in the cards for the average person who's getting started. I like to recommend things that are, I learned a long time ago that the more expensive and the more difficult it is to implement, the least likely someone to do it. And so I really focus on the things that are easy, affordable, and fast, and that really move the needle for someone in the preparedness department. And that will always probably be my focus.
So would that include if you're not going towards solar, then like having a generator at home to power?
Yeah, you know, I'm a huge proponent of solar and solar generators and generators in general. But all of those, you know, I prefer, my tendency is to offer solutions that are even simpler, that just don't require power whatsoever, in order to maintain a sense of normality over the course of a few days or even a few weeks, which is what we're really looking at for your average disaster, right? I mean, your average disaster, you're not trapped in home for 4 months, you know? I mean, I don't even know I've ever heard of that, let alone expected on a regular basis. So, but a few days, a week, a couple of weeks, that stuff happens all the time in some areas of the country. And so I love the power-free options for that reason. You know, Yeah. You're not storing fuel. You're not making a big upfront investment in a generator, whether it's $1,000 or $10,000, or converting your electrical system to solar. These are, you know, just turnkey solutions where almost, you know, we're just kind of backing up the technology 100 years.
Yes. Okay, so part two of your book is on water, and you go into this pretty big explanation of chlorine and how we need to understand chlorine and how it can benefit in terms of long-term water storage.
Yeah, great question. So the good news is that most people don't have to think about chlorine. The good news is that most people who are storing water are going to go buy it in bottles or in jugs or in 5 gallon containers, or they're going to turn their tap on and they're going to fill up jugs and containers with tap water from their municipal water supply. And if you do that, you can feel pretty confident that that water is going to be good for up to 5 years. But if you're on a well, or if you're sourcing water naturally, maybe through a rain barrel, then you do need to think about chlorine, not only to make it safe to consume, from microbiological standpoint, but in order for it to store and keep bacterial growth and parasitic growth at bay, you wanna add in a little bit of unscented liquid chlorine into that water at a ratio of about 2 drops per 1 liter, in order to not only drink but store that water.
If you are just joining us, we are speaking with Creek Stewart. He is the author of The Disaster Ready Home, a step-by-step emergency preparedness manual for sheltering in place. As you put this book together, Creek, what did you learn about your own preparedness? Was there anything that you, as you're researching this book, has helped you that you teach people now?
Yeah, there's one in particular, and it's a composting toilet. So that was one backup plan that we hadn't really taken seriously as a family. And so while I was writing the book, we took 8 months. My son and I took 8 months and used a makeshift composting toilet instead of our regular flush toilets, because You know, it's not uncommon for those to be taken off grid in earthquakes or in floods or in a variety of other disasters that may interrupt water or sewage facilities. And so the ability to contain and deal with human waste is a huge issue. And not doing that properly can really lead to some serious consequences. And so we built a 5-gallon bucket composting toilet. Just go to the hardware store, buy a plastic 5-gallon bucket, order on Amazon or some other retailer a snap-on lid. It's about $15. A toilet seat bucket lid. They make those. And then go to your local hardware store or wood shop and ask for their leftover sawdust, and they'll give that to you for free. You put a layer in the bottom of that bucket, and then you go number one and number two right on top of that sawdust, and then cover it up with another layer of sawdust. And do that until the bucket's full. And when it's full, you snap on a solid lid and slide it over into the corner or out in the shed or the yard. And in a couple of months, that becomes manure that you can safely dispose of, composted human manure. And it's a perfect, inexpensive, it's a great example of a super simple, inexpensive solution that can 100% solve a major issue in a disaster preparedness scenario. And everyone, that's a project that every single household can do this weekend for $20. And you don't have to use it, although you will wonder, why in the world do we have flush toilets, because it's so effective. But you can just put that in the corner of your garage and stow it away for, you know, your next camp out or the day when you might actually, your life might depend on it.
And what you didn't mention, but it is in your book, is that the sawdust, it just doesn't smell. And you can get it for free.
It does not. I was very surprised by that. I mean, we used this for 8 months and filled up multiple buckets of composted waste, and all in our garage. And there is absolutely no odor whatsoever that emanates from those buckets. I don't know the fizz behind sawdust and how that deals with that, but I'm telling you right now, it is a modern marvel and flat out a solution to a major issue.
Okay, before we let you go, I have to ask you one. It's a little gross, but, you know, since we are talking about composting toilets, we do exactly what you described when we go camping, but we don't put the number one in it. And I'm surprised that you say to do that. Do you know what the reason is?
The ammonia, maybe.
Okay, I'll go with that.
Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio. Creek Stewart, he's written The Disaster Ready Home, a step-by-step emergency preparedness manual for sheltering in place. Creek, we wish you continued success.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks, Creek.
Thank you.
And stay with us. We will be back in just a moment. We'll be speaking with Josh Fishman, Senior Editor of Medicine at Scientific American, some COVID updates when we return.
With all of today's economic news, some businesses just aren't sure how to react.
It's a risky environment right now to be doing business. We're holding off on major capital investments, and we're just in sort of a holding pattern.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, making sense of the business news even when you don't know your next move. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday afternoons at 6:30 p.m. on KPCW.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We were just speaking with Creek Stewart. He's a Weather Channel host and author of the new book, The Disaster Ready Home. Now, a taped conversation with Josh Fishman. We taped this just last night. It's very current. We hope you enjoy. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Our next guest is Senior Editor of Medicine at Scientific American, Josh Fishman. He joins us from time to time. He also hosts a podcast called COVID Quickly. He joins us this morning to give us some updates on things like immunity to COVID, what's happening with Omicron, Where is that Omicron booster and who continues to be protected against COVID? Josh Fishman, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Lynn. It's good to be here again.
Great to have you back. You know, we have you back on the show as often as we can, you and your sidekick, Tanya Lewis, but there is some fatigue talking about COVID. However, things are switching up rapidly enough now that I think people are really tuning back in. Do you find that at Scientific American?
Definitely. We're all going through this just like everybody else. And that fatigue that you talked about is, it's oh so real. You know, I think, and I'd be interested to know how you feel about this. You know, we all thought in the summer that we were starting to see the end of the tunnel. Then Omicron hit and it turned out to be wildly infectious. And there are breakthrough infections, even of vaccinated and boosted people. It just seemed like we were back where we started because we all had to be so worried now. I mean, and I can talk more about that. We have tools now that we didn't have a year ago. So we're not actually back where we were a year ago.
Those tools, I assume you're referring to vaccinations, boosters. We have a little ability to find out about our immunity, you know, whether or not we have neutralizing antibodies. So are those the tools that you're talking about?
Yeah, really primarily the vaccines. The vaccines were just being rolled out a year ago, you know, January 21. Remember how scarce they were and the tiers of people that were eligible. You know, you were looking at your state and the rules and trying to figure out when your turn would come up. You know, people were driving, you know, for hours to get a shot. And now we have the vaccines. They're all over the place. They're easy to get, and we know that they work. In terms of preventing really serious COVID, you know, bad illness that lands you in the hospital, now we can do that. And we know that that is the effect of the vaccines. When I get down, I remind myself about that.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Josh Fishman. He's the senior editor at Scientific American. I listened to a podcast this morning. I'm not sure if it was 21 or 22, but it basically said, one of the things that it said was that Pfizer and Moderna vaccines were 90 to 95% effective at stopping infection. And then Omicron came along. And now two shots of Pfizer vaccine are only 33% effective at stopping Omicron infection. I had a question for you, Josh, and that was, there's a report out of the UK that says that there are some people that in this study that got Omicron, recovered, and within 30 to 45 days caught it again. Have you heard anything like that?
I'm not familiar with that report, but I have heard about people getting reinfected. It's not a lot. It does happen. And really the question is whether these reinfections are severe illnesses or whether they're like getting a cold. A lot of the reinfections that have actually been studied, and Omicron itself has been relatively mild compared to the disease that we were scared of a year ago and the disease with a Delta variant that we were scared of this spring and summer. To me, you know, the question is, are people who got infected, getting reinfected and landing in the hospital or spending 2 weeks on their couch? Or are they getting reinfected and they're sneezing and coughing and then 4 or 5 days later, they're feeling pretty good? If it's the second thing, then I think that's part of learning to live with a virus that's just going to be with us for a while.
That's right. And so let's go back and talk about the common cold, the cold virus, and its relationship with COVID-19. I learned in your podcast, we have some people have cross-reactive T cells that may help them.
Right, John. I talked to an infectious disease physician in England, a guy named Ajit Lalvani at Imperial College London, who did a very interesting study looking at what keeps people from getting seriously ill with COVID. And we all know that from the beginning of this pandemic, some people got mild illnesses and some people horribly ended up in the hospital on ventilators. You know, all around the world, 5 million people have died. So there's been this range of serious illness to mild illness or no symptoms at all. And he wanted to know why some people got sicker than others. He was able to do this study looking at T cells, which are parts of your immune system. There are T cells called killer T cells, which do just what they say. They find cells in your body that were infected with the virus and they kill them, killing the virus in the process. And there are other cells called helper T cells, which kind of enhance your immune system and help direct the killer T cells to their targets. And what Lalvani and his team found in the study was that people who got infected from somebody living in their house with COVID didn't have a certain kind of T cell, but people who remained healthy, who did not get sick, even though somebody in their house was infected with the disease, did have some of these T cells. And the interesting thing about these T cells is that the T cells seem to have been created by your body in response to a completely different kind of coronavirus, a kind of coronavirus that causes the common cold. It's a coronavirus that's been around us for thousands of years. Our bodies have evolved to adapt with it and have these T cells. And these T cells react to both kinds of coronaviruses, the cold-causing coronavirus and the pandemic-causing coronavirus. If you have T cells that cross-react this way, it seems to help your immune system fight off the pandemic-causing coronavirus. So that was pretty interesting.
That's really interesting. So a couple of weeks ago, we had someone on the show from a laboratory in Kentucky. They were producing these antibody home tests. It was a finger prick, you know, drop of blood on the swab and send it away to find out what level of neutralizing antibodies you have. Of course, at the end of it, they couldn't tell you if your level of neutralizing antibodies occurred because the booster was still working or because you had had asymptomatic COVID. You know, they didn't know where it was from. So I'm wondering if the same sort of thing exists for being able to measure the amount of T cells you have that you're talking about.
Short answer, no. T cells, sorry. T cells are harder to measure than antibodies. And I'm actually glad that you brought up neutralizing antibodies because it's a good thing to talk about them and T cells at the same time. One of the reasons that we talk so much about neutralizing antibodies is because they're actually relatively easy to test for. You're doing a big international trial of a Pfizer vaccine, for example. You use neutralizing antibodies as your measuring stick. It's easier to look for those in 40,000 people than it is to look for T cells, this other component of the immune system that fights the virus. It's just you have to culture them. You have to have very specific kind of molecular fishing nets to filter them out of samples of people's blood. They're just harder to work with than neutralizing antibodies. But I think that what we're learning is that the T cells are very important components in your virus fighting army. They haven't gotten as much attention as they should. They seem to be involved in, for example, people who have a stronger response to the vaccines when they're inoculated, they have more of these cross-reactive T cells. Another study of healthcare workers who stayed relatively healthy during the pandemic, they also had more of these T cells. So yeah, they're harder to measure, but we really should be paying more attention to them as a very important part of our virus fighting repertoire. Vaccine companies are starting to incorporate parts of these T cells, or I should say they're starting to incorporate parts of the virus that triggers these T cells into next generation vaccine shots.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about next generation vaccine shots. A booster for the Omicron doesn't exist, and I'm assuming that it doesn't exist because it's come so quickly and we're going to see more and more variants that come on the stage quickly and possibly leave quickly. We have some hope because a lot of cities and even countries are showing that Omicron has peaked out and now they're on the decline. Will vaccine manufacturers pivot to create boosters for these variations?
Excellent question. We just ran a story on this reported by my very excellent colleague, Charlie Schmidt. Vaccine makers are not jumping at rolling out an Omicron specific shot. I think that there are reasons why they're going slow, but there are also reasons why they might and maybe should go faster. We can talk about those. Pfizer and Moderna, the two big manufacturers in the United States, have boasted about how quickly they can turn around shots that are specific to variants, but they haven't done that. Even though right now they say they're working on testing shots that are specific for Omicron, they haven't started the large-scale trials that are needed to gauge the safety and the efficacy in people of those shots. And it takes 4 to 6 months to go from designing a variant-specific shot to getting it into full-scale production. Exactly like you said, Lynn, what these companies are worried about is that these variants have come and gone very quickly, like the beta variant. Remember that one? That showed up and was gone in 2 months to be replaced by Delta. They're worried that by the time they turn their production facilities around, stop making the original shots, start making an Omicron shot, Omicron will be gone. And as you pointed out, we're already seeing evidence from South Africa and also from the UK that the Omicron peak there is starting to decline. So that plus the fact that the shots that we have now are still very good at keeping people out of the hospital means that these companies aren't running out and saying, all right, we're just going to like drop everything and we're going to develop an Omicron shot. The turnaround time, they think it's too long. The shots that we have now are still keeping people from getting seriously sick. Charlie, my colleague, talked to Paul Offit, who's a very, very smart vaccine specialist at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. He said that right now, about 2% of COVID cases end up needing to go to the hospital. He would get worried if that number jumped up to 15% or 20%. Our healthcare systems are already really stressed, but you know that would be awful. And that would be an indication that the current vaccines aren't working and we do need to switch to something new. We haven't gotten there yet. We're right now at about, at that 2% rate. Companies are making bets that they can keep boosting these vaccines, giving us more shots. Israel is testing a fourth shot, a booster shot, so the original two shots plus two boosters. That's the company perspective. There are some virologists who are skeptical of that, though. They think that Omicron is infecting enough people that because of that widespread infection, so many people getting the virus, that it's going to give rise to new variants. And those new variants, since they come from Omicron, are probably going to look pretty much like Omicron, these virologists say. Why not develop a vaccine around Omicron that would work against Omicron? And if the next wave comes with a variant that looks enough like Omicron, the vaccine will work well against that.
Josh, I'm curious, as we study a virus, as we study COVID and the different variations of it, and we look at the current variation, which is Omicron, can we anticipate what the possible configurations could be, how it would evolve? And if we can do that, and if we have done that, is there anything out there that tells us that possible configurations of future variations will be less contagious, more contagious? You know, what sort of parameters?
I wish I had a better answer for you on that one, John. I really do. And I think a lot of virologists and immunologists do as well. What this pandemic has done repeatedly is surprise us. There are virologists. There's a very well-respected one named Ralph Barrick at the University of North Carolina, who thinks, as I was saying before, the next set of variants could look a lot like Omicron because they're probably going to evolve from Omicron.
Right.
You know, Omicron itself came out of left field. We didn't know that, you know, it looked nothing like Delta, which came before it. It had a whole bunch of extra mutations. You know, it has turned out to be very hard to predict because the virus does have a lot of opportunities to mutate.
Yeah. So
like I said, I wish I had a better answer for you.
My 62-year-old brother tested positive in September. He was ill for 3 weeks, but he recovered. Now, he's never had a respiratory problem in his life. And 60 days after recovering, he had problems breathing, went and saw the doctor, and the doctor told him he had COPD. What is the latest? What have we learned so far about long haulers?
Long haulers or long COVID? Well, what we've learned so far is that it's real and that it is yet another reason to get vaccinated. When you compare vaccinated people to non-vaccinated people 6 months after infection, the vaccinated people had a lot fewer cases of long haul symptoms. The symptoms we're talking about are the kind of fatigue that makes it hard for you to get up and down a set of stairs, brain fog, you know, you have trouble making decisions, remembering where you get your keys. If you don't want that, vaccines are, you know, another good bet for avoiding that. You know, long haul COVID is a real thing. It's something that this virus does. I think that some studies have shown that maybe a third of cases have shortness of breath, fatigue, 6 months out after their initial infection. I was just talking with a friend of mine who had been infected about a month ago. He still had a cough. You know, get your shot. It improves your chances tremendously, and stay safe.
Josh, there's a province in Canada that is requiring vax cards if you want to walk inside a liquor store or a marijuana store.
That's well,
I think we got some incentive going there.
There's a certain segment of the population that will work really well with. Out where you are, maybe, you know, they should require vax cards before getting on a ski lift.
How about that?
There you go.
I wanted to ask you before we let you go about testing and rapid antigen testing. I think you and or your colleagues have written about this, when those tests are useful, because we have found recently, in fact, a place I go to get tested will give you the PCR test. They won't even give you a rapid antigen test unless you have really, really obvious symptoms, because they say they have such a high rate of false negativity. What are you saying about the usefulness of testing?
What I'm saying is that's really not true, that high rate of false negativity. It depends on when you use the rapid antigen test.
Right.
When you use the rapid antigen test the right way, you get very accurate test results. And the right way, and this is actually important now because federal government just opened up a website that's going to mail you 4 tests. A lot of places are requiring these tests. The tests are most accurate when you have been infected for a few days and are starting to show symptoms. So if you get a test right away, it might have one of those false negatives. But if you wait 5 days after you suspect you've been in contact, and certainly if you are showing symptoms, then the rapid antigen tests agree with the PCR tests about 98% of the time. And that's pretty good.
That is pretty good. So when I got a test back, I guess it was the PCR test, and I had also heard the 5 days after my exposure. And when I got it back, it said, this will be accurate as long as it was 7 days after your exposure. And I went, wait a minute, I thought it was 5 days after the exposure. So, you know, everything's changing all the time. You're sticking with the 5 days after the exposure, at least for a rapid antigen test.
At least for the rapid antigen test. The PCR tests, if a testing center told you that they're accurate 7 days after your exposure, that means that they're really trying to rule out any sort of problems. The PCR tests are very, very sensitive. They'll detect tiny amounts of virus in your saliva, and they should be able to do it as soon as the virus starts replicating in your body, even before you get symptoms. That could be within 2 days, 3 days. But the problem is that in most cases, PCR tests are not rapid. So if you need to get on an airplane, if you need to go to your kid's wedding, if you need to go to school, you can't just go get a PCR test and then go do those things because it's going to take a lab another 3 or 4 days to get the results back to you.
Right.
Hence the rapid antigen tests.
Well, Josh Fishman, senior editor at Scientific American, it's always great to have you back on the show. And again, COVID Quickly is your podcast. You co-host that with Tanya Lewis, also a senior editor there at Scientific American. Each episode is, 5 to 7 minutes long? So it's like the most up-to-date information, research that's distilled down from bigger studies and journals, scientific journals. We appreciate the work that you do.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on here, Lynn and John. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and you guys ask such really interesting questions.
Well, thank you,
Josh.
Again, Josh Fishman, Scientific American. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Thanks to our underwriters, Peak Murray Real Estate, San Francisco Design, Nexus IT, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. As always, you can find our archive shows under our podcast, KPCW Cool Science Radio. They also appear on the KPCW website, kpcw.org. Lots of good information out there. We love our listeners. Thanks for supporting Cool Science Radio.